सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उलहक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। द न्यू गवर्नमेंट इज इन, नया पाकिस्तान इज ऑन एंड वी आर ऑल एक्सट्रीमली एक्साइटेड अबाउट इट। इमरान खान इज लुकिंग टू द डायस्पोरा एंड आई थिंक इट इज इम्पॉर्टेंट दैट वी स्टार्ट टॉकिंग टू डायस्पोरा एक्सपर्ट्स, पीपल हु नो द सब्जेक्ट, एकेडेमिक्स इन द वेस्टर्न वर्ल्ड। So today I've invited, I would say I'm thankful to Muhammad Hamid Zaman, a professor at Boston and as well as connected to Harvard, to talk to us about higher education in Pakistan, especially in view of the new Pakistan that Imran is envisaging. And we are hopeful that someone on the team of Imran will be listening to this, but that's besides the point. So long as the youth and young kids are listening to it and learning from it, that's the important thing. So welcome, Hamid.
It's a pleasure to talk, sir. I'm really honored and glad to be here.
Thank you. Hamid, sir, very briefly, if I can ask you, zara sa apna background, thoda sa, if you can tell your background a little bit to kids so that, you know, people have an appreciation of who you are, what you've done. I know you, but it's good for kids to know you.
Indeed. So, Dr. Hari was born in Islamabad. I grew up in Islamabad. My father was an academic, a historian. He was affiliated with Khalid Azmi University for a long time. He was briefly the vice chancellor as well, Ganab Dr. Wahidu Zamantha. And I grew up in a very academic environment. So my brother is an academic. He teaches at Princeton. My sister is the chair of history at Khalid Azmi. My other sister is a doctor. So I grew up in a very academic environment. And have always appreciated people and intellectuals and those who bring new and fresh ideas. So that's the environment that I grew up in Islamabad. Mm-hmm. Went through the public school system, Model Colleges of Islamabad, the Abhimiyya. Came to the U.S., did my undergraduate PhD, and my first academic job was the University of Texas at Austin. That's where I started my career after my postdoc at MIT. Aur uske baad, then I got recruited here to Boston University in 2009. Moved through the ranks of academia here, and now I'm a full professor here at Boston University. My research interests, Dr. Saab, are in three broad categories. One is, I would call, sort of bioengineering and sort of the science component of that, that's focused on cancer. The largest of the three research interests is in global health. Something that I've always carried with me. वहाँ पे मेरा जो major interest है is on pharmaceuticals, access to pharmaceuticals, equity, quality. My book, Bitter Pills, just came out, published by Oxford earlier this year on this topic.
Give us the title of the book again.
Bitter Pills.
Bitter Trails.
Bitter Pills. Kadvi Goli.
अच्छा, okay, Bitter Pills. Okay, very good. Okay, Hamid, we shall have to have a conversation, a podcast on Bitter Pills now. Okay.
Bilkul.
I think that's very important in biotech. But today, Bilkul. I think we should, as you suggested, we should focus on education or higher education because, A, it is your interest and you are Wahidu Zaman's son, a very important academic that we all know of, you know, admire. So I think, and coming from your academic family, I'm sure you have strong views on this, and I love people with strong views. So please tell us, what do you see? In as briefly as you can, what do you see as the problem in higher education in Pakistan? And, well, first let's see the problem, then we'll come to the solutions.
Bilkul. I feel that there are three fundamental problems. Ek to there is problem jo ke sirf higher education ka nahi. Wo hamara in general problem, and that is of ethics, right? I mean, and that's a problem that is bigger than higher education, that is associated with do nandri or in general, ethics. Let's put that aside for a second because that's a universal problem in the country.
That's a country problem, yeah.
And the other problem jo hai is quality control. So there is, I mean, we get fascinated by buzzwords and what I would call style over substance, the new fad that's in humanities and social sciences, but a lot more in sciences and engineering also. So do not sort of prioritize rigor or quality. We are interested in rankings and impact factor, jo bhi, right? So that's the quality issue. Or teesri cheez jo hai na, wo access ki hai. So who gets to be at our universities? The reality is ke a lot of access problems exist. So university leadership, despite the fact that women outnumber men in nearly all medical schools in the incoming class, leadership is not women. The fact is that women, if you have FSC or metric marks, they can consistently outperform boys. They are not really reaching universities in the numbers that we expect them. Even if they are, they're not moving through the ranks. So you have the problem of access and you have the problem of quality, which is a deadly mix, which you really need to address. And this has nothing to do with innovation or Pakistan 2025 or Pakistan 2050 or AKM. Ye wali cheez bana de or wo wali cheez bana de. It is a fundamental question of who are you educating and what education are you providing them.
That's an interesting thing. So what you're saying is, normally we talk about spreading education and we talk about giving everybody as much education as possible. But you've got a very interesting spin on that. You're saying that, hey, it has to be quality control, rigor, and making sure that the access is given to the right talent. As we move through the ranks, women and you know other groups drop out. So focus on that a little and tell me, what do you mean? Should we just get more women into universities to, let's say, make them vice chancellors or make them run the place? Or what is the solution here?
I think we want to make sure that we are inclusive and we have to look at systematic barriers. I mean, ladki se puchein an honest conversation, ki does she aspire to be the university vice chancellor? And she would probably say no. Lekin aap kahenge kyun nahi ho kahenge main bhar nahi sakta. And I've had many of these conversations, right? They discount themselves because the system doesn't allow them. Shaadi wali ko alag rakhe, the system is toxic. The system is... I was sitting at a meeting, I won't go into the detail, and there were faculty members, or a faculty member ne dusri khatoon se kaha ki aap the bibi ka chai bana de, right? I mean, if that is the kind of place that we expect our women faculty, where they are not equal citizens, then the likelihood of them really moving through the ranks is going to be minimal.
But how is there the fundamental problem? I was in the government, as you know, for 3 years as deputy chairman of the Planning Commission. And honestly, in the Planning Commission, I remember one evening, there was a woman who was crying all over the place and making a scene. And everybody said to me, don't talk to her. So finally, I said, I can't take it. And I invited her and talked to her. And she had actually been driven mad in an all-male planning commission. She was the only woman there. And she was mistreated in many ways. And she was now suffering a lot. And the problem, every meeting I went to, I noticed there were hardly any women there.
I completely agree. This is slightly besides the point. Aaj, agar aap tasveerein dekhein, jo assembly nahi swearin ki hai, aurtein kahan baithi hain? Peeche. I mean, they're equal numbers of parliament.
Yeah.
Right? So we have this access issue, and we are really not tapping into that. Okay. And then there's the quality issue, right? I mean, jab aapne metrics bana diye ki ji humne itne papers produce karne hain ya humne itna se karna hai, then you're also going to lose out on that.
So basically, you are looking at this that HEC has this issue of that they made this metric that the only thing that counts is impact factor journals, and everybody has to produce a certain number of impact factor journals to be able to get promoted. This is a very Taylorist approach. You remember that old, you know, from the 1920s, a guy called Taylor, a famous management consultant, he measured everything in quantitative terms. And the US went through that period for about 30 years, and then they realized that their quality was falling and Japan was overtaking them. They gave up Taylorism. But we have got Taylorism in HEC, is that correct?
Absolutely. Bilkul. I mean, to the point that you're reducing the overall impact footprint of a scholar by a number. Kiji, aapka number kya? I mean, it is a sort of, sad reality, very Orwellian like, right? Where the government gives you a number, somebody gives you a number, and that's your total. Aapki puri jo mukat hai, aapki puri, it comes down to a number. Kiji, aapne impact factor journals mein kitne paper published kiye? Regardless ki us paper mein kya tha, uska koi fayda hua ki nahi? Original kitna tha? You might even be 24th author in a 42 author list, but that counts because it got published in Nature, as opposed to something that is original and authentic, and you can take pride in it. And it has created sort of these widespread practices which are just deeply troubling. Lekin usme jo dusra jo challenge hai na, wo, and they do it, perhaps, I don't know their intention, but they do it ki kehte hain ji, agar hum ye nahi karenge to log kuch karte nahi hain, wo aise baithe rehte hain, wo baithe mukhya maange. All of that may be true, but what you've gone is you've said ki ji, aapki promotion, or in some cases, aapka bonus, right? Each individual paper provides a bonus.
Yeah.
And that is just a terrible, terrible thing.
So it's basically an old Taylor approach. that we are using, where we are measuring everything in very quantitative terms. And academics basically is not a quantitative subject, right? Atau Rahman, for example, the old chairman, and Sohail Naqvi, the old director general, we had a lot of debates on this. And they said, no, our first issue, tell me if you agree with them, they said, our first issue is expansion of higher education, increasing access. So they have now created 200 universities across the country. And we are building more. For example, today, Asan Iqbal put out a tweet saying that Narowal, his constituency, is building a university as well as the University of Engineering Technology. I don't know why there has to be a difference. I mean, most universities are one thing. I mean, they do everything. MIT may be called technology, but it does everything. But if we are building two universities in Narowal, which apparently is a city of ostensibly of 100,000 people, we are expanding access. We've got about, I think, 3 million kids in universities. And they say that we have to expand access and make sure we get a number of publications. This is the first stage. Next stage, maybe we'll do something else. Would you agree with that strategy?
I think the access thing is very well taken. I think we do need access. Like, I mean, there are many universities, and Mesoamerica's example is coming with this primarily the wood. Are not research tier one universities. They produce outstanding scholars. Aapke liberal arts college, I mean, aapke Wellesley's and Swarthmore's and Harvey Mudd's, these are not research intensive places. But they produce outstanding people who move on in government and industry and academia and all of that because the quality of education that they get is of the highest standard. Somehow, humne universities ko bana diya hai, I mean, they're not very well run, but the idea there is that they have become research institutes. So just cheese ke, I mean, there is no education left in higher education. So that continues to be a major bottleneck in terms of how we train people. I mean, we don't allow certain seminars to happen at universities because they ruffle political feathers. We don't allow students to independently think. We don't allow a bunch of interesting ideas to flourish and proliferate for a variety of reasons. Like, if you talk to students, I'll give you a very specific example at a university in Pakistan. I always go there and give lecture to first year students, and every year I'm fascinated how smart they are, and I'm depressed at how constrained we ask their thinking to be. Wo bichare jo hain, wo I'll give you a very specific example. I did something intentionally incorrect, and I said, "Ki jis mein kya galti hai?" Wo bache bichare kehte hain, "Sir, aap to galti kar nahi sakte, because you're the expert." So I was really depressed. Why aren't they challenging? Why aren't they really thinking? And they're very capable kids. I mean, I'm a product of the system. You are a product of Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Others are. Mm-hmm. And we can see of source of them. Coming back to the higher education part, and I'll sort of mention one other thing that is needed is, ek aur fascination jo humare haan hai, wo ye ki ji, hum MOUs sign kar dein with sort of name brand universities. Wo MOUs jo dusri side pe sign karta hai, is some kind of a bureaucrat who has no interest in Pakistan, who has no interest in higher education. And these things are just, I mean, nice certificates on the wall. Unka koi fayda nahi, chahe wo Chin se kare ya Sweden se kare ya America se kare, they'll make for a nice soundbite and a nice news story, but they are not really helping the institution build. So my argument is, which I've sort of said earlier on as well, that you need to build a relationship of trust with individuals, people who are interested in Pakistan, either because of research interest or because of other reasons. Build a relationship of trust with them, people who are card-carrying researchers and doing good work. Help the faculty members work with one-on-one rather than building this higher-level MOU. Aapka vice chancellor ko bhi kuch nahi pata, unke bhi jis bande ne sign kiya tha, unko bhi kuch nahi pata. And you spend a lot of money. And HEC did that. I mean, unhone kaha ki hum 8 universities chaina ke sath banayenge, 15 hum Sweden ke sath banayenge, whatever the number was. And it didn't amount to anything. Kuch bhi nahi hua usse, aur hona bhi nahi tha. Aur abhi bhi nahi hoga if they keep doing the same thing. So my argument is to focus on quality and work with individuals. Let your faculty determine ki ji aapke university ke growth areas kya hain, needs kya hain. Try to develop relationship with individual faculty, even if they're not in the fanciest of universities in the US or for Europe.
Let me explore this a little. We are fascinated by this, that if we can have an MOU with Harvard or, I mean, Harvard is going too far, but I mean, for example, USAID put in these four projects that I know of. They spent $130 million putting up one center of excellence in Faisalabad, one in Peshawar, one in Mehran, and one in Nust. And now I have talked to some of those people, and it seems that the agricultural, the Faisalabad center has folded up and very little is left behind. And the Peshawar center is kind of going, but they're worried about where they're going to go after the funding dries up this year. And the Mehran center has done relatively well, but the others are kind of floundering. Nust, I don't know what's happening. Now, the issue is, this has happened before too. This has happened way back in the 80s, 90s as well, and people, these institutions from the West come in supposedly to mentor, and nothing much happens except that they get a lot of money, because these universities are also not philanthropic organizations. They take a lot of money for doing this. I believe for setting up the centers, the universities in the West, Davis and others, took $10 million of the chunk of money. So they took more than one third. They took more than one third. And then that's just the fee. But then after that, the consultants, when they come in, they take more money. So they take away roughly 50% of the money.
Absolutely.
And our guys remain in a junior position. They never grow up. And in a sense, the inferiority complex grows. And then we go out looking for more funding. The second thing that EACH has done, which I also find remarkable, for each conference, you're supposed to invite some international academics. And I've been to a few of these conferences and looking at these academics, I wonder what the hell is happening. Where did these guys come from? Yeah, they have white faces, but they are generally from all kinds of small places and not necessarily, you know, of a very good quality. But our academics are really running around trying to get them, but they don't develop enough confidence themselves to give a talk. And the conference happens and it dies. So I've often gone to these conferences and said, look, guys, are you sure we are having a conference or are we having a shadi?
Bilkul.
Because the approach is, let's have a khana, let's have a ceremony, right?
Bilkul. So, these partnerships and MOUs, I know a little bit about the one in Mehran and us as well because of some people I know in that area. Many of these, and again, not specifics, but many of these partnerships are with institutions that are looking for their own financial interest. They're also trying to diversify their own funding. It's very competitive in Bikaner or elsewhere. उन लोगों को सर पहले भी नहीं पता होता ना पाकिस्तान के एनर्जी सेक्टर का ना पाकिस्तान के हेल्थ सेक्टर का. They come and so पहले दो तीन साल जो you spend tens of millions of dollars on just trying to educate them. उसके बाद वो लोग move कर जाते हैं, वो centers को funding दोबारा नहीं मिलती. And these things just don't pan out. So my argument is, and I strongly believe, कि work with individuals जिनको कुछ पता है and try to build individual relationships. जो कि आपकी फैकल्टी को बेनिफिट भी करेंगे आप यू एंड अप पार्टनरिंग विद दीज यूनिवर्सिटीज एंड यूनिवर्सिटीज के ब्यूरोक्रेट्स आते हैं दे डोंट टीच यू एनीथिंग दे डोंट टीच यू हाउ टू लुक एट दीज कॉम्प्लेक्स चैलेंजेस एंड देयर आई थिंक सम ऑफ माय ओन एक्सपीरियंस इन ग्लोबल हेल्थ मे हैव समथिंग टू ऐड क्योंकि ग्लोबल हेल्थ में चूंकि इतने पैसे नहीं है सो पीपल इनवेरियबली वर्क विद इंडिविजुअल्स एंड देयर वी सी गुड पेपर्स कमिंग आउट चाहे वो आखान के हों चाहे वो लियाकत मेडिकल के हों चाहे वो गुलाब देवी के हों लाहौर में. And there, because the relationships and partnerships are driven by individuals who know something about whether that disease outbreak or whether they know something about Pakistan or they know about health system, those relationships kahin zyada payedar hote hain. But it's with ye ki these uber fancy things that ji humne farane ke sath bhi kar diya aur humne padna chain ki university ke sath kar diya aur aajkal I think the flavor du jour is Turkey, jo bhi. And I think that's quite troubling. So my argument is that ke build organic strength, get your faculty to say ki ji aapke interest kya hone chahiye. HEC in Islamabad shouldn't be saying ke Lahore ki university is pe kaam kare aur Sindh ki is pe kaam kare aur Baluchistan ki is pe kaam kare. So organic strength is one.
So what you're saying build, is basically a bit of a decentralized pattern.
It's absolutely. Universities need more autonomy. Universities, I mean, I'll give you a very specific example. This is something that I talk about in my book called All 4 years or 5 years, jitne bhi hote hain, pharmacy ke, and basically tells each university ke har bachche ne bas yahi padhna, and there is no autonomy, there is no sort of flexibility, and there is no innovation. So HEC sitting in Islamabad tells every university ke aapne ye karna hai padhai mein aur ye karna hai aapne research mein. Aur this is just a sort of a colonial mindset of institutions that doesn't allow individual institutions to develop their own sets of strengths and their own innovative ideas. Of course, it is risky. So, koi kahega ji isme nuksan hoga, of course hoga. But the upside is ke when people will come out of that and those who succeed will really be of very high class. I wouldn't say necessarily ke they'll be immediately world class, but they'll be much better than what we have sort of humne unko bandh ke rakha hai.
Okay. So basically, your approach is to give the universities autonomy, right?
Bilkul.
And now, but there's a fundamental problem there, Hamid. Our universities, I'm sure you've been to a lot of them, I've been to some of them. Do our universities have the faculty to take on the leadership role?
That's a great question, Dr. Lekin. I think we have to giving them some trust, right? We have to start believing that they have their own best interest at heart. Mm-hmm. And if given a responsibility, some of them will fail, but some of them will rise up. I mean, we are basically telling them that the bureaucrats of ATC or bureaucrats of government, some of them may be education experts, some of them may not be education experts, are going to tell that these sare mulki universities are going to ek hi tarah ka uniform banana university.
When you teach, kya aapke jo syllabus hain, they are given to you by some central body?
Absolutely not. So there are broad guidelines. These are the things that you have to cover, and that's about it. And even within that, there is flexibility. To the point, when I teach a particular course, and another faculty member teaches the same course, there is significant difference.
So in your university, if you teach, for example, biotechnology 301 or 305, whatever, biotechnology course or a global health course or whatever, you could be teaching it this semester, this subject, as whatever, your choice of topics. Some other guy teaching it next semester could have a different choice of topics.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, Doctor, what you're trying to teach is not the specifics of a particular problem set or an approach, but teaching students how to solve problems that come their way. And I may choose a different set of approaches so that they're able to solve the problems in biotechnology. And somebody else may say, Ning, I'll use these to inculcate the same level of curiosity and interest. And then both are valid.
In Pakistan, ATC expends a substantial amount of resources setting up committees to set syllabi for each subject in each course. So that would be counterproductive according to the way you think of things.
It is, and we know that. I mean, I think there's enough data showing that, and we know, for example, that Pakistani students, in many cases, unfortunately, are not as competitive as their peers in elsewhere, and partly because of the fact that they do not have the ability to creatively think. And when you see some of these students moving on, who are presumably quite smart, they are unable to really think beyond the proverbial box. So I teach, I taught for a couple of years at the Salam Center, course on biomedical engineering and some work with cancer. And I was really disturbed by the fact that they thought computational biology is all about software and things like that. And I said, I'm not even going to tell you what software to use. I am going to write things on paper and pencil. And people were just struggling, how do you write a problem that won't require a software, right? They have been trained ki bas jaake aapne ye cheeze plug in karni hai aur isse ye niklega aur ye karega. And people, eventually they were very happy, but they were really, really troubled ki aise kaise ho sakta hai. Aap jo hai, you take a step back and start thinking about fundamentals and big questions and a discussion-based class. I mean, how does that work? And that is quite troubling. I mean, they were really happy at the end, but they were troubled because this is not the way they are taught how to really engage. So, and I think they're doing a disservice to them in that.
So I take your point. One is that the uniformity in syllabi and not giving professors the opportunity to think for themselves. I remember, for example, when I was a graduate student, I was very fortunate that a number of Nobel Prize winners teaching me. So I remember, in fact, in Chicago,
by the way, I did my grad school in chemistry there.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. So I didn't know that. So we were together for years, old Chicagoans. Huh? Good.
That's right.
Okay. Now, but there were two Nobel Prize winners who would teach the same course in macro, right? And that macro course would be taught one semester, quarter system. And the next quarter, the same course would be taught by another guy. And we would attend both courses because they had different approaches.
Absolutely. Right?
And same thing on micro. I mean, Gary Becker would teach one course. Sherwin Rosen would teach another course. They were both Economic 301 and they were both very different courses. And you had to attend both because, hey, there were very different approaches and you needed to learn that. So that's a very important thing. The second point, let me ask you, tell us, what is it like to be a professor in an American university, because a professor in a Pakistani university feels that he is like at the beck and call of the vice chancellor. The vice chancellor can call him at every second and he has to go there. And secondly, he is also at the bottom of the pecking order. The Secretary of Education can call him whenever he likes. And he has to, he's kind of doesn't have that self-confidence that he is a professional in his own right.
I think that you really nailed it, Dr. That's exactly right. So you have to give them autonomy and confidence. Give what he is the expert, not only in what he or she does in the lab or in his or her research, but also in the classroom. That you would defer to him or her being the best judge. You expect a certain level of course integrity, you have accountability, you expect a certain level of competence, you expect a certain level of hard work, but ultimately, they are the experts, and they are going to be judged at the time of promotion, not by the department chair, but by their peers, and not by the university, but by they'll sort of reach out to their peers, letters licking, all of that thing. But at the end of the day, you give them that autonomy, and of course, with a risk, they may fail, but you give them that autonomy, they are going to be in charge, and you hold them responsible. We have certain metrics of success, you either reach them or you don't. But we are not going to sort of hold their hand, kiji, aapne is class mein ye kyun padhaya aur ye kyun nahi padhaya, and all of those things. And I think that is very important. And we need to really rethink in higher education that people who are supposed to be very good, and I'm sure they're very bright young men and women who are entering academia in Pakistan for all the good reasons, I hope, you give them that autonomy. You give them that sense of independence that regardless of their sort of background, socioeconomic background, political views, that they are going to be people of high integrity and, of course, people who are going to be held responsible for their actions, and you expect them that they will do their work successfully.
No, but Hamid, this could be the problem. Tell me. First of all, how often does the vice chancellor or the president call you to his office, and how often do you have to attend his meetings or whatever?
So I don't have to attend any meetings. I mean, I should, and I do, but requirement koi nahi. I mean, it is being a good citizen that you attend. And if you don't, koi kuch nahi kar sakta, or na karta, right? That is not part of the contract. The part of the contract is you do good research. The part of the contract is you are going to be hopefully a good citizen in various ways, and you're going to sort of do your job at time. Lekin, aapki peshi nahi hoti, and vice chancellor or the chair or others are not going to hopefully tell you. And those are not good chairs. The best chairs are the ones who get out of your way and let you be the best scientist, the best scholar, the best historian, the best economist you can be.
So what is expected of you?
So what is expected of me is basically that I will have a vibrant, independently funded research program that I can attract good funding, that I will be a mentor to graduate students and postdocs who will move on to their careers.
So the university doesn't give you research funding?
University does give you research funding initially, but eventually the idea is that you will have a self-sustaining program, that you are going to be globally competitive and respond to the calls from NIH and NSF and Gates Foundation and USAID and others, and being able to, because university expects your graduate students, you are going to be you're going to pay for them.
Okay, so basically you raise the funding for your graduate students, right?
Yeah, bilkul.
And now, what is expected of you in terms of teaching? I mean, Pakistan, for example, HEC says a junior faculty member must teach three courses a semester, and an associate professor will teach two courses or something. There's a very heavy course load out there too.
And it's exactly opposite. Because what you want to do is you want to give the junior professor as much time so that he or she can develop their research programs. Mm-hmm. And it's rather counterproductive and counterintuitive that they would junior really carry the heavy burden. Mm-hmm. In our department and many other departments, junior faculty have less of a teaching load than some of the associate or senior professors. Because mm-hmm. you want to give them time to establish them.
Okay. Now, the other thing is, that do you, for example, in terms of education, what I remember from Chicago and LSE and the places that I've been to, that a large part of the education is really extracurricular. For example, I remember in Chicago, if I remember right, we had almost about 20 workshops or seminars in the economics department every week. And the business school also had another 40 or 50, maybe more workshops. I mean, so maddening that I had to spend most of my time running around between workshops. And that was a huge amount of education happening there. In Pakistan, we don't have any seminars at all. Do you have any seminars? Is that a part of
it? Doctor, I mean, the expectation is that the classroom is now a place of discussion of ideas, but real teaching actually, and real learning rather, happens outside the classroom, right? And that's something we have to think about, is that through various modes and modalities, chahe wo online learning ho, chahe wo books ho, chahe wo seminars ho, you have to really, people will learn through multiple ways, and the professor is in many ways a facilitator of that learning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a primary driver of that process.
Now, for example, I've noticed when I go and give a seminar, for example, recently I gave a seminar at LUMS, and I've done that many times. And LUMS is a leading university in Pakistan. It's not a sort of secondary university. And I found that faculty members don't feel the compulsion to attend seminars.
There's also a problem here. Or I think the reason are different. In Pakistan, they don't necessarily find value. Here, they probably are too busy and there are too many things going on. So it depends. I think, okay. Lekin students should and encourage properly, they do attend. And I think there is value in that. So mera jo, I mean, I think many of these reforms, and I want to end soon for another call or something, but mera jo point hai higher education reform ka, wo basically ye ki many of these things don't require extensive long-term and billions of rupees funding. Many of these are structural and behavioral things that can be changed and that should be changed.
So very briefly now, since you have to go, very briefly, that we have covered quite a few topics. And in particular, one of the two or three things that come out very clearly, one is that you're saying independence of faculties, some flexibility, independence of universities. I mean, in a sense, what you're saying is the faculty really should be research entrepreneurs and leaders. And the second thing, you talk about access, which is very important, that how do we include women and everybody and not just, for example, there's too much elite status or whatever. But very briefly, tell us, what are the other things that you are thinking about in terms of, in terms of reform in education, higher education? What would you advise Tariq Banuri, for example?
I think we have to sort of break down some of these silos. I think we have to move beyond them. PhD advisor at Chicago, so again, we were talking about LUMS. So when LUMS colleagues asked him, what should a modern chemistry student study? And my PhD advisor said Shakespeare. And the point was that we need people to be able to think and critically analyze and learn from other disciplines, right? So I, for example, asked my engineering students to write op-eds. I asked them to read sort of contemporary Latin American literature and things like that. And the part of the reason is not that I will protest, but I want them to get exposure to creativity in all of its manifestations, or certainly some of its manifestations.
Right.
And that is something we absolutely have to give to our students. Mm-hmm. Creativity is not just in the lab, or creativity is not just with a tool in your hand, but instead be exposed to great ideas, be exposed to provocative questions. I mean, Rika May, for the longest time, they used to have courses on great books, they would call it core. We need to have that too. I mean, we have a rich body of literature, of art, of music, of history, and our students have absolutely no exposure in an academic sense to dissect Ghalib and Iqbal and Faiz and Bulleh Shah and others. Why not?
Now, let me ask you another very important question, which I'm struggling with right now because I'm doing a review of the university research system. How do you characterize research? What is research? For example, let me put it very concretely. Let's take the University of Sialkot, for example. Sialkot is a very interesting city. It has a long-standing export industry that you know of. It has the private sector has got together, built their own airport. They're kind of an entrepreneurial people. What should the University of Sialkot be doing? Should it be, for example, concretely integrating with that system there, solving the industry's problems, the current city's problems, or should it be taking out these big impact factor journal publications? Which would you?
So I'm not on the impact factor journal thing. That you'll never find me supporting that. I think the first model is great. I mean, part of the reason Chicago has sort of has had a strong program in sociology and African American history and civil rights is because it was a place where many of these things were debated in the 50s and the 60s. So university has to be integrated in the environment that it's in. So if Sialkot is the entrepreneurial city, where questions of of entrepreneurship are asked, I think university has a role to play. In many ways, I would go farther and perhaps take a more radical view. The university has a responsibility to play. That includes ethics, that includes new ideas, that includes debating existing practices, that includes sort of equity and things like that. I think university has a role to play, and both sciences and humanities. I think that is absolutely critical. And that is going to be important. I mean, so why does, for example, the University of Texas have a strong program in Latin American studies? Because they're closer, because they see a lot of sort of immigrants and migrants coming from South America. I mean, so same thing you would find in universities that develop within the region and go beyond that. Like, that is absolutely critical. I don't think a Sialkot should be told, ki ji, aap sab yehi karein, yehi na karein, but they should certainly be encouraged to really benefit the local economy and benefit from the local economy.
So what you said, the message that you're giving Pakistani researchers or academics is, hey, look around you. The problems are right there. Instead, what we're telling them is, hey, you know, go to US and think about what they are doing or whatever. Get integrated with the University of Texas or University of Austin or whatever, and, you know, try and learn from them. I think what you're saying, I received that very well, that learn global wisdom. But absolutely. Seek to apply it in your environment.
Absolutely. And own your problems. And the best place, I mean, universities are a bubble. They are not often reflective of their society, but they're a bubble for a good reason where you can debate and discuss without having to worry about the consequences and think of great ideas and solutions that really change societies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think that's very good. Very, very, very valid. So, Hamid, that's excellent discussion. Very briefly, let me ask you my last question, last two questions that I put to everybody. Person like you. Very quickly, if you can give some ideas to students, like you've given a very good idea right now in terms of research. People are looking for an MPhil or a PhD or a BA, you know, thesis in general. Let's not talk about your subject. We'll talk about that later. What is the approach that they should be taking in terms of looking for these topics?
I think this is what I tell my students. So I tell them, look for three things, right? One is, do a little bit of a soul-searching exercise. Mm-hmm. Ask yourself what you're really interested in, because that is absolutely critical. Intuition. Dusra, seek advice of as many people as possible, right? So mentors in your institution, mentors abroad, whatever. Do get their advice. You don't have to follow it, but do get their advice. What do they think? What are their life experiences? After they worked in it, itna kaam kiya and have had a great experience in that. And the third thing, which I think is the single biggest problem, read more. We have somehow in this generation of Twitter and social media, I mean, you ask people, okay, what was the last book they read? And they would have a hard time.
Depressing, yeah.
So reading doesn't have to be it allows you to really expand your horizons and think. So that is something I tell them. Okay, read more.
And read beyond your subject.
Absolutely. And especially read beyond your subject. And you'll find your inner calling. You'll find your aspirations. So that is absolutely true.
I often ask young people, hey, what's the last book you read? And they tell me their subject. And I say, hey, I'm not talking about your subject. Are you reading a fiction book of fiction or not?
I mean, apne aakhri, when was the last time you looked at a picture in a museum? Right. Or any of that.
Yeah, good idea. Okay, last question. Recommend a book, a movie, or whatever that you think has influenced you the most that people listening to this podcast might also be influenced by.
So one of the books that I've read not too long ago is the reason it has influenced me in many ways, it's called Cutting for Stone. It's by an Indian by descent an Indian scholar. His name is Abraham Verghese. Uh-huh. And he grew up in Ethiopia at the time of Ethiopian when they were going from Haile Selassie's time to the communist revolution. And it's a long family saga, but it's just absolutely beautifully written. He's a doctor now. He is a professor at Stanford. Writes incredibly well, but it's really a tale of struggle, of fears, and it's just an absolutely fantastic.
The name is Cutting for Stone.
cutting for stone. It's about a doctor's decisions, ethics. It's about good decisions and bad. It's about colonialism. So it's really, I mean, I would consider it to be among the favorite books that I've read. And,
thank you.
And it's just really phenomenal. I can give you a long list, but that is a book that I would say.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm going to recommend that to my daughter to read first.
Okay, sure. I'm happy to tell the back stories about, I remember he was actually the first person who also wrote about HIV in rural communities in Tennessee. Oh. It's called In My Own Country. Mm-hmm. It's really a fantastic, he's a fantastic author and somebody whose native language is not English, who grew up originally from South India, grows up in Ethiopia, comes to U.S. as, goes to medical school in India, comes to U.S. as a fellow. Mm-hmm. But his just command of his language is amazing and his he's just a phenomenal person. And he's now also the leading person in America who people go to for just training of how to be a good doctor, how to listen with empathy.
So it shows you, Hamid, that there are sort of diamonds in the rough all over the world.
Absolutely.
And all the university has to do is polish them and cut them well.
But
unfortunately, you have to go, diamond cutters. Stone ki salahiyat dekhte and then we cut it according to the needs of the stone. We don't cut the stone to our needs.
Bilkul.
And that's what the university should be doing. So thank you very much. Wonderful conversation. Time we will discuss Bitter Pill. I must learn more about that. I'm going to get that book and then we will talk about it. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Hamid. Thank you very much.
All the best.
Yeah.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.